Well, good morning, everyone. So we thought we would start the year, almost the beginning of the year, with giving the pastors, each pastor, a Sunday to talk about what's on his heart. And so last week, Mike talked about the need, how important it is that people understand who God is and have a chance to do that. And I'm going to talk this Sunday, and Greg speaks next Sunday. And I wanted to just talk about one of the things I think God is showing me as I'm getting a little older. I think I'm gaining perspective as I mature, and I had a view when I was younger of what a successful life was. What is a successful life? And what is a successful Christian life? And I wanted to lay that out for you a little bit today. So why don't we pray, and we'll dive into where we go today. God, thank you that you are real and you are true, and thank you that you help us. You're not idle, you're not distant. You're intimately involved with all of our thoughts, all of our struggles, everything before us. Help us today, help me to communicate well, and I pray that we would see you more clearly from being here together. Amen. So in thinking about life, I have this little progression I made in kind of my view of life. I was born here in America. It's not my fault. It's not. It's where I was born. So I grew up with an American view of life. And in my opinion, America really has had a prosperity in recent history that may be unparalleled. And for a variety of reasons, God's blessing is obviously one. And another one is a focus on principles that work, that were incorporated. I mean, for a perspective, and this may seem like an odd perspective, 100 years ago, people who had, we all have flush toilets and running water, right? All of us do now. 100 years ago, that didn't exist. Didn't exist. And we think, well, we're here. We have that. That's normal. Doesn't everyone have that? We expect that in our lives. You know, most of the world, most of the people in the world don't have something, don't benefit from being able to turn a faucet on and have clean water come out that they don't have to worry about. They get sick if they drink it. But we think it's normal. We take it for granted. And part of that is from being here in a country that's focused on principles and that work, and God has blessed that, and it's part of the American experience, part of being here in America. And I went to church a little bit when I was younger, didn't know if God was real or not, and decided I would find out, and decided to read the Bible one day. There's got to be something in there about God, and I found out there was. There was, and I found out that I wasn't a Christian. I had just been in the church and listening, and I was younger. We counted the ceiling tiles because we were bored in church, and found out there was much more to Christianity, and I became a Christian. And so I added my Christianity to my American view of life and my American view of success. Well, now that I'm a Christian in America, I will go out and be successful, and we'll work on things, and we'll plant churches, and people will come, and we'll be wildly successful. That was somewhere in my thinking. And in some ways, it hasn't totally turned out like I originally thought. And I go, wow, well, was I wrong? What do I do now? Should I go do something else? My expectations. It's not exactly the way I thought it was going to be. And well, how does God look at this? What's the biblical view? Is the biblical view the American view that you will always have what you expect? It'll always go well. It'll always just move forward if you work hard at it. And I do work reasonably hard. I know what hard work is. I value that. I preach it. I talk a lot about it. I do it sometimes myself. I tell all of our high school students, you should work hard. Most of them. Because it creates great opportunities. And I lament with the probation officers I talk with about how young people that we are dealing with together often struggle to have a good value and a good work ethic. But that's another story. So I'm going, what is God's view? God's view. And I'm just comparing numbers. Being an American, we're into success. And in some ways, I think the American church is, we look at success. I know a reasonable number of pastors. I know pastors of very big churches, churches of 3,000 to 4,000 people. I know a few pastors in that. And if I measure that, I go, wow, look at that. Look at those results. Isn't that great? Isn't God with them by the numbers? By the numbers. And I don't think so. And I don't think so. I think God measures things not by numbers, but by faithfulness. And I'm going to give you a weird example. So I've started this video business. I want to do all drone video, but now I'm doing social media videos too. And so you know how you put your video on YouTube and people watch the video, and you can see 8 people watch my video. All these people watch, you know. And so most of my videos have been properties and houses and things like that, because that's real estate. And so, you know, I'll get 40 or 50 views, which in YouTube world is not a ton, you know. So my biggest, bestest, watchest video is a Christmas video. I actually found a live nativity in downtown Wheaton, and I filmed it, and it came out pretty well. And I set it in black and white, because everyone knows that 2,000 years ago, the world was black and white. It gives the impression of being old and vintage. So I did that, and that, as of last night, has 358 views. And I go, wow, that's pretty cool. That's maybe the way it should be, that the one video I have about Christ coming to the earth, the only religious one I have, has the most views. Now, I ran into a guy who, he's got a small organization, and he's got a guy doing video for his organization, too. And we were at a meeting. He says, yeah, one of my videos went kind of viral. I got 36,000 views. 36,000. There's one guy on YouTube who's kind of an eccentric. You know how if you're kind of weird, you get popular on YouTube. And if he does a video, he gets 3 million views, you know. And I got 358. So I go by the numbers. I got 1% of the average guy. I got point something percent of the Casey Neistat, everyone loves the guy with the weird hair and the sunglasses in New York guy, right? But you know what? I looked, and actually, my video is about God coming to earth. And actually, the analytics, I looked at some people in the United Kingdom, not a few, maybe 2 or 3. The United Kingdom actually watched that. I go, well, that's pretty cool. Someone overseas watched this, and there's a chance they could learn about who God is. I think the one person, the individual, matters to God. I think it matters to God. I think He measures faithfulness. I don't think God works by the numbers. I don't think He grades things like I do, like we often do in America. I think He grades things by faithfulness. And I want to look at a few verses to look at what He promises. Because it's easy to get caught up, I know I have in that God measures faithfulness. Sometimes no one will know, no one will see, but God will see. And that is what He values. I want to look in Deuteronomy in the Old Testament. So I'm going to go to Deuteronomy 10, 12 to 13. And now Israel, speaking to Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? He requires only that you fear your God and live in a way that pleases Him. And love and serve Him with all your heart and soul. Now look at this, verse 19. You must always obey the Lord's commands and decrees I am giving you today, for you will be successful. For you will have many numbers. He doesn't say that. I'm misquoting the end of the verse. For it is for your own good. It is good for you. He doesn't promise all your expectations, but He promises that it's good. Promises Israel, if you do what's right, if you follow me, if you give your heart to me, if you love me first, it'll be good. if you're faithful to me, it'll be good. It'll be good. We're going to move into the New Testament, into Hebrews, Hebrews 10:23. The Hebrews 10 and 11, they talk about faithfulness in people who dared to stand for God, people who dared to live a different life and stand for who the Lord is. And this is what he says in 10:23, let us hold tightly without wavering to the hope we affirm. For God can be trusted to make you very successful. I misquoted it again. God can be trusted to keep his promise. God values faithfulness because he is faithful. He always keeps his promise. If you find a Bible and find a promise in the scripture and apply it to your life, you can always trust God. You always can trust God that he will be faithful to what he says. It's who he is. He can't be anything different than anyone different than who he is. And he is calling us as Christians to be the same, to be different than our culture, to be faithful to who he is. So sometimes if you live a Christian life, if you dare to do this, it's not going to be popular. Even Jesus said, the world will hate you because they hate me. They hate, who wants to be told, hey, you're doing some things that aren't right. You're not good enough. Ever been told that? You're not really good enough. Well, to measure up to a holy God, we're not. No one is. No one is. So if you stand for that, the world doesn't like that. They want to think, hey, we're all okay. I'm okay. Aren't I okay? People who are being drawn to God will realize that. I can't stand before a holy God. I need someone to cover me. I need someone to pay for my inadequacies. That's what Christ did. Everyone needs that. That's a repulsive idea to some people, that they're not good enough. They want to measure up. Oops, skipped a slide. My thought was here, you were born, most of us, I think, in America, too. You don't choose your time. You don't choose your circumstance. But you can choose what you give your heart to. You can choose what you love. What you invest your time in, what you spend your time on, you will end up liking it. That's most of the way it works. You know, I love things that fly. I was trying to think about why. My dad is a hardworking guy, but flying is the thing we did together. I think one of the reasons I like flying so much is because I love doing things with my dad. That's what we did. We built and we flew stuff and we crashed and we fixed it, and I just loved working with him. It was just good. It was he and I together. And so now I'll look online, and I think I have 15 or 16 things, maybe 20, that fly right now. Aside from the broken ones that need to be fixed. If I look online, I'll go, oh, look at that airplane. That is really cool. I need that one, and then I'll be happy. And that one too. I could love it too much. I can like things too much. What we invest our time in, we will grow to love. You spend your time with God, you spend your time looking at what he promised and how much he cares about you. If you invest your time in understanding how much he cares, your relationship with him will grow. If you do that, this is where I was going. If you live for God, you will find that you will suffer for it somewhere, sometime, because you're not doing what the world is doing. You'll not do it. So 1 Peter, he says, if you are suffering in a manner that pleases God, this is interesting, keep on doing what is right. If you're suffering for God and it's the right thing, keep going. Do I throw in the towel? Do I say, oh, that's it, I'm done, I'm out. This was hard. I'm checking out. I'm going another direction. keep doing what is right, and trust your lives to the God who created you, and He will never fail you. He will never fail you. We're going to face that. We're going to face struggles and difficulty. I think it's actually harder to live a Christian life because you're going against the grain of the culture. This was mentioned in Revelation 2 to one of the churches. It says, don't be afraid about what you're about to suffer. He's warning the church. The devil will throw some of you into prison to test you. You will suffer for 10 days, but if you remain faithful, even when facing death, it's only death. This is the perspective of Christian life. What can they do? They can kill you. But your life, you live forever. Your life is with God. There's a reward for that. I will give you the crown of life. Be faithful to who God is. If it's the right thing, be faithful to who God is. It's always the right thing to do. So, in my understanding, I realized in America, I measured success by numbers. And sometimes numbers are deceiving. I think if a person helps someone else, God values that. There's some people, by their station in life, have no opportunity to have numbers. But God values their service. God values their compassion. God, if they help one other person, God values that. God values and measures faithfulness. Now, there's a Christian author who wrote a book called Your Best Life Now. I never read it. I won't buy it. I won't read it. But I disagree with the title because I don't think it's on a Christian basis. You can have your best life now. How do you look at that? You're going to tell the church, you're going to have your best life now. Tell John the Baptist, who was beheaded, you're going to have your best life now. You can't promise that. You can't promise that. It's unbiblical. Christianity is deferred gratification. Your best life is later. The great rewards are later. So this is how I think maturity works, and this is just in my own thinking. I've been thinking about how does maturity work in Christianity, and I think there's a progression. So if you start out, there are times and there are areas and there are people who are ignorant. I don't mean that in a demeaning way. The definition of ignorance is you don't know. You really don't know. There are a lot of things I still don't know. I am ignorant. We don't understand that, right? So if there's no one, that's where it starts. There's things we don't know. There are people who don't understand the truth about Christianity, the truth that God will judge their life. They will stand before a holy God and God will judge. People don't understand that. We like to pretend that's not real. The next step in maturity is awareness. Oh, yes, there are those rules. There are those laws. Ever been on the highway and been driving along for a while and go, I wonder what the speed limit is here? And I've done that. I've been driving for a while. Maybe it's 75. Maybe, right? Then you see a sign and you're doing 75, 80 and the sign says 55 and you go, oh, I am aware that the speed limit is lower, right? So after awareness means you have an understanding. It doesn't mean you do it. It just means you know. The next level is a growing compliance. Okay, here is something I should do. It's safer for other people if I do what's right and obey the law. Growing compliance. By compliance, I mean you understand it's good. You start doing it, but your heart really isn't in it. Why do I have to drive? Why is the speed limit here to slow me down, to impede? It is an impediment on my life, this law they made that Jimmy Carter did when he reduced the speed limit to 55 miles an hour. Do you remember that? To save gasoline. We have lots of gasoline now. We should get rid of that law. That's my opinion. What's the next level? Growing compliance. I comply with the law because I don't want to get into trouble. The next level is I value the truth and the law. The law exists to help people. Help people be safe. I value that. I value being safe. I value that, you know, it does help to have some boundaries. It does help to have the police out there. I had a friend who got caught drag racing doing, not recently, we were in high school. He had a Trans Am, to show you when I was in high school, they don't make it anymore. Actually, the whole Pontiac is out of business, right? He had a Trans Am with a big V8. John's here, 454 cubic inches, you remember that. So he had a friend look at him, and they look at each other, and they decide they're going to go, you know, and they went, you know, on the Berlin Turnpike, and he was doing 110 miles an hour. By the time they got pulled over, once you're over 100, they consider it drag racing. Not sure why I shared that. No bearing to where we're going. Value the truth. We can value it sometimes, that it makes people safer. The policemen pull them over and say, you know, you can't do this. You can't do this. It's a danger to you and to other people, and it scares the neighbors. Please stop. Here's your ticket. Here's your ticket. The next step. I value the truth. I do it. The next step in maturity is to live to promote the truth. Not only is it good, not only is it right, not only is God real, not only is He going to judge every person, but I'm going to make it my goal to live to help people know that. You can't go speeding down this road and think there's no consequence. I'm here to warn you. I'm here to warn you. I'm here to warn you that if you keep doing this, you're in trouble. This is the right way. This is the bad way. You know, at the intersection of the Washington and Geneva and 59 here, I was going across and I could see, I heard this engine rev. I was a guy in one of those super bikes, they call them, and he had revved the throttle up, and he pulled a wheelie, and he was riding a wheelie through the intersection, and the bike got away from him, and it spun out from under him, and it slid across. All I see is the bike sliding across the intersection, and he's behind it, sliding on the ground. And he was fine. He was a little scraped up. He was wearing a helmet, and it was pretty spectacular, and the bike slid into a car or something, and everyone stopped, and it was, you know, he was horsing around. The police came, and I'm going, I got to stop and talk to this guy. Because I do things like that. I don't know why, but I do. I stopped it. I said, I looked at him. I said, and the police weren't there yet, so it was my turn. And I said, hey, you are lucky to be alive. You are lucky. Do you see this? You are lucky to be alive. You should go to church next Sunday. That's exactly what I told him. You should go to church next Sunday. You see this? You know, easily you could have died here. Then the police came and they wanted to talk to him about something less important. So, risk. If you risk talking to people, if you risk your life, you're going to spend your life on something. We really do risk. We don't realize it. We're risking our lives. We're risking the philosophy we believe. What we spend our time on turns out to be what's really valuable. Take the risk to trust that God is real and being faithful to Him and growing in that, to learn to live for what He says, is going to measure up in the end. That's what He promises, to be faithful to Him. It may be popular. It may not be popular. It will not be popular sometimes. I can almost guarantee you that. There are times it will not be popular to stand for what's right. People don't like that. So I want to, the last thing I wanted to mention is this progression is I'm going down is, what does it mean to go all in for God? If God is real, and what he says is real, and he's coming back, and he saved us from ourselves, what does it mean to go all in? Because sometimes things get hard, and you go, well, I don't know if I want to keep going. Even the disciples face this. After Jesus was crucified, they all went fishing again. And Peter says, I'm going fishing. The implication is, the Greek is, I'm going back to my old profession, going back to what I used to do. The guy we were following, he's dead now. This didn't work out like I thought. So I want to tell you a story. This is in a book called All In by Mark Batterson. And this is a true story about a guy named Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. He became the governor of Maine, actually. And he was a commander in the Civil War. I want to read this story. This is from the Battle of Gettysburg and what happened. So here we go. Joshua Chamberlain was a student of theology and a professor of rhetoric. Not a soldier, but when duty called, Chamberlain answered. He climbed the ranks to become a colonel of the 20th Maine Volunteer Infantry Regiment in the Union Army. On July 2nd, 1863, Chamberlain and his 300 soldier regiment were all that stood between the Confederates and certain defeat at the Battle of Gettysburg. What was happening was no one was guarding the Little Round Top. It was a mountain that Lee was trying to take possession of. General Lee, who had an eerie sense of the battlefield. He says, if I can get my troops up there, I can roll through the Union lines and separate the Union Army from Washington. That was his goal. Chamberlain and his 300-soldier regiment were all that stood between the Confederates and certain defeat at the Battle of Gettysburg. The regiment started out at 1,600 men. Now they're down to 300. At 2:30 p.m., the 15th and the 47th Alabama Infantry Regiments on the Confederate Army charged. But Chamberlain and his men held their ground. Lee's army followed a second, a third, a fourth, and a fifth charge. By the last charge, only 80 men in blue stood standing. Chamberlain himself was knocked down by a bullet that hit him in the belt buckle, but the 34-year-old school teacher got back up. It was his date with destiny. When Sergeant Tozer informed Chamberlain there were no reinforcements coming and his men were down to one round of ammunition each, Chamberlain knew he had to act decisively. Their lookout, a young boy perched high in a tree, a Little Round Top, informed Colonel Chamberlain the Confederates were forming rank. The rational thing to do at that point, with no ammunition and no reinforcements, would have been to surrender. But Chamberlain wasn't wired that way. He made a defining decision that turned the tide of the war and single-handedly saved the Union. In full view of the enemy, Chamberlain climbed into their barricade of stones and gave a command. He pointed his sword and yelled, "Charge!" His men fixed their bayonets and started running at the Confederate army, which vastly outnumbered them. They caught them off guard by executing a great right wheel. And in what ranks, one of the most improbable victories in military history, 80 Union soldiers captured 4,000 Confederates in 5 minutes flat. What seems like a suicide mission saved the Union. So this is a story, true story, of what happened there. He says, what can I do? This is hard. This is not what I expected. I can shrink back, but if I am standing for what is right, I have one bullet left. What do I do? We're going to charge. Because this is right. Did he know if they were going to live? How could he know? He says, we're going to charge. We're going to go. We're going to go. And it changed the course of the war. And if you think that God doesn't see things like this, I became a little enamored with this story, and I looked up a few details. So in the Battle of Gettysburg, I want to read you, this is a more detailed account from CivilWar.org. Chamberlain seems to have been blessed by good timing and luck. I don't believe in luck. He made not only the right command decisions, but also managed to survive when by all rights he should have been dead. Listen to this. An Alabama soldier twice failed to pull the trigger on his rifle because he had second thoughts about killing the brave colonel, this Alabama regiment. So there's a guy on the other side, right? They're both Americans. One's the South, one's North. He had him in his sights, and he sees this brave man leading this small band of 80 soldiers. And he goes, I can't shoot him. Look at him. After that, then a pistol aimed and fired by a Southern officer misfired only a few feet from Chamberlain's face. What do you think happened? I think God intervened. I don't believe in chance. I don't believe in luck. I think when God sees someone being faithful, he intervenes to help what he wants to go forward. To go forward. So where are we in all this? I think we have a great opportunity. Not an easy opportunity, but a great opportunity. We live in a very unique time in our country where people are very confused about what is true, what works, even what truth is. You know, everything is relative, and it just doesn't work that way. We have an opportunity to help people understand that they can be reconciled to God. You know, in my personal reading, I've decided to read the one-year Bible, and I've been using the Faith Walker's Journal has what you're supposed to read every day. And I've been reading in Genesis the story of Joseph. Now, Joseph came from a dysfunctional family. If you think your family's a little weird, now here's a family where dad loves the younger son too much, and all the brothers hate it, and they decide to kill him. And one brother says, hey, don't do that. Let's sell him off into slavery. This is a better idea. And he goes and is exiled. And I'm reading this story. You know, and usually Bible reading, I read this and then I stop because I'm done. But in this story, I'm going, you know, I want to read the end of the story. I'm going to keep going. And I'm going, that's kind of unusual. I would like to read more. But I like this story. You know what? I go, well, what do I like about the story? I'll show you what I like. I figured it out this morning. I'm reading the story. Oops. He gets to see his brothers again. He was estranged, sold into slavery. God used him in a miraculous way. Joseph, the guy who they were going to kill. Finally, he says, weeping with joy, he embraced Benjamin. Benjamin did the same. And Joseph kissed each of his brothers and wept over them. They've been separated for years. And they began talking. They didn't know it was Joseph. And they started telling the story, and they finally met. And he couldn't stand it anymore. He says, it's me. I am Joseph. I love the story of reconciliation. That they are everything that went wrong is forgiven. I love that. That's what I wanted to read about. That's why I kept going. That story exists for every person. The ability to be reconciled. So my encouragement is, even though it's hard, let's be faithful to go all in this year and live for God in that way. Why don't we pray and we'll have the music team come up. God, thank you that you call us to be faithful because you are faithful. All of your promises are true. Thank you for encouraging us today. Amen.